Hello and welcome to the Ship Energy Podcast. This is Mark Williams broadcasting to you from sunny Cambridgeshire in the UK. My guest today is Mr. Stephen Lua. Stephen is the CEO of Unitrove Group and has been since founding it in 2008. Stephen has an engineering degree from the University of Oxford. Big up to Oxford, my alma mater, and also has experience in banking, software and engineering before setting up Unitrove. Unitrove is a bunkering company that focuses on zero carbon fuels. But Stephen's going to tell us all about it. Stephen, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Mark. Really a big pleasure to be here.
Well, I'm very delighted to get you on. I know you're very busy in advance of COP26 coming up, and we're all sort of running around like headless chickens in advance of that. So delighted to get you on for a few minutes. But for those who don't know you, would you mind introducing Unitrove to us?
Yeah, ultimately here at Unitrove, we're looking to decarbonize the maritime sector. And I guess what better way to do it than to try and build the world's first liquid hydrogen bunkering facility for fueling zero emission ships. And ultimately, this is a project that we're looking to deliver in time for COP26 and will be just the start of this massive decarbonisation of maritime.
So the world's first physical hydrogen bunkering, liquid hydrogen bunkering facility.
Correct. That's right. Yes.
And where's this going to be?
So ultimately, we've decided to build this off our own back, quite funny enough. Let me just take you a little bit back for some of the listeners here. We actually built the UK's first liquefied natural gas bunkering facility back in 2015 at Teesside. And ultimately, this was the starting point for the kind of the evolution of the concept of where we are today. Back then, of course, some 6 years ago, LNG as a bunker fuel was very new. I mean, technically is still quite new today to some people. And we worked on developing a solution there to bunker two liquid ethylene gas carriers on behalf of Shell and SABIC, I think. And yeah, I think that was something that we recognized was quite impactful in what we were doing. But with all the recent movement towards net zero by 2050, sort of higher up the agenda of eliminating carbon, we actually started to look and investigate into hydrogen as a possibility. And given our background in understanding how to handle flammable gases, cryogenic at that, that we thought that why not liquid hydrogen? I mean, liquid hydrogen has been used in rockets for many, many decades since the 1960s. And so we felt that the technology was actually quite robust already, but the only fact was that it hadn't actually found its way into other industries. So we thought, why not think about trying to apply this to shipping? And so that's where we sort of set about taking the concept that we had from the Teesside project and developing something not massively dissimilar, but ultimately for liquid hydrogen.
Astonishing, because people talk about, oh, it's so expensive to set up the infrastructure, but you sound quite, I wouldn't say blasé about it, you seem sort of quite comfortable and au fait with it. How did the Teesside infrastructure work? Did you have to build your own LNG plant? Or?
Yeah, I mean, that project was a bit easier for us in the sense of that it was being financed by somebody else. Ultimately, this liquid hydrogen bunkering facility is self-funded. That is to say that we've not actually found any external financing from governments or people like that. I mean, we did obviously consider some grants and things like this, but actually by the time the UK government had announced different grant programs and things like this, it was actually coming too late for us. And we thought we couldn't wait. And therefore we just went ahead and tried to invest in this ourselves without that support. And I think one of the things that's quite interesting to see when people are sort of saying, oh, this is too expensive, things like that, is maybe it's that kind of view that's coming from external consultants that are making their best guess to what things actually cost. But obviously, as a company that manufactures these things, we actually literally buy the components and put it together. We know exactly how much these things ultimately cost. And in that respect, we can get a better feeling for how much we feel these things should be costing in the near run and also the long run as well.
So the LNG was in Teesside in the UK. Where is your hydrogen bunkering station going to be?
Yes. So ultimately, the first initial plan is to take it to Glasgow. That's quite clear with the COP26 conference. And of course, there'll be many people. We'll have leaders there, politicians. We'll have people from the shipping industry that wants to understand better how that technology looks. And ultimately, thereafter, I think it's going to be a case of we'll wait and see. We actually, funnily enough, made this announcement that we were going to do this back sometime in the summer period. I think it was like July or sometime around there. And actually, when we put out that press that we actually were going to do this, we got a lot of significant interest from all around the world, actually. There were organizations that were saying, hey, we're looking to build a liquid hydrogen ferry. It's going to be ready in maybe 2023 or 2024. And it's going to require X amount of liquid hydrogen. And, you know, and these were, as I say, you know, from all places around the world. I mean, I believe there were pilot projects in California that is going on. Norway is clearly a leader in liquid hydrogen as well. We also have some interactions out in Singapore and also, funnily enough, have done LNG projects out there, you know. So we had a lot of significant interest, and not also least from the ports as well. We had a lot of interest from various different UK ports. I mean, Scotland, I know, there's a few different ports that have inquired about it. Teesside, naturally, of course, where we've already done some work already with LNG, is an obvious fit. Also, because the UK government has a very political agenda in the Teesside, in the so-called levelling up, and the fact that Teesside is, I believe, the UK's first hydrogen transport hub, and also now a free port. So I think for us, it's a case of evaluating at the end of our showcase where we feel that it's next best for this facility to be in. And, you know, the idea is that once it's built, it's ready to go. People then don't have to wait for, you know, however many years it will take to have a facility in their hands. And if they want to try it out, we can lend it for a very short space of time. And, you know, if they're done with it, then we'll happily take it back. And I think that's the concept that we really want to try and push, this idea of zero emission infrastructure as a service. So ultimately, we're trying to de-risk everything to the end user. That's everything from the ship owners not having to, for example, pay directly for the capex, or not having to worry necessarily about the risk aspects of it, because, of course, we've made this system as safe as possible, all the various different safety features, including breakaway couplings, gas detection, e-stop systems, ship-to-shore links, all this sort of thing. And then also de-risking it from a deployment side of things or an operational side of things. So, you know, we're able to sort of communicate with ports and make sure that these are sort of located in the right places and that sort of thing. And really where we want to get to it is that all the ship owner has to do is to tell us how much fuel they want and where they want it. And that is it. So, yeah, in terms of location, I think it's a case of we will wait and see.
So is your system a mobile system then?
That's correct, yes. And in fact, it's probably a lot smaller than many people. The unit, in fact, that we're actually going to be showcasing at COP26 is probably no more than 2.5 meters long by just over a meter wide. So this is something that almost you could probably tow on the back of a car. But people are surprised by the size because they think, hang on a minute, these ships, they're, you know, well over 100 meters long. These are great, ginormous vessels. How is it that this very small little piece of infrastructure is able to deliver fuel into such large ships? I think that's the beauty of being able to showcase solutions like ours, because that will then answer a lot of questions that maybe people would think, well, you know, we've got big ships, therefore we need big infrastructures to match it. And these big infrastructures, therefore, are going to be costing millions and millions of pounds. And quite frankly speaking, that's not necessarily true at all, especially with the way that we've designed our very flexible systems. And I'm happy to kind of talk a bit more about this in the sense that it's, again, the same model as what we did with Teesside, mm-hmm. the LNG bunkering, where actually it's kind of like a pumping skid unit in a box with all the safety features built into it. And actually the storage, in the case of Teesside, of LNG, and in this new case now, of liquid hydrogen, actually arrives via ISO containers or as road tankers. So the way we see it is that maybe a road tanker would fill itself with liquid hydrogen. It would drive across to the port where our fueling box would be ultimately. And then the road tanker would then connect to our box, and then our box would then connect to the ship. And ultimately, then there would be a bunkering process that would happen. And once the bunkering process had been completed, then the liquid hydrogen road tanker could be disconnected and taken away. And the great thing about that is that there is no requirement then for storage of flammable goods at a port side. And that really helps with permitting and planning. You know, ports are not actually designed, or they don't generally have the capabilities in many ways, actually, to look after large scale flammable storage. You know, that's not really their business. And so by completely removing this need for hydrogen storage or liquid hydrogen storage at the port side, because it could be taken away, actually makes their life a lot easier. Now, granted, that's obviously for the slightly smaller to medium type ship fueling applications. But in the way that things are going, these are probably going to be the start of the projects. This is where, you know, the market is going to be building from. So it makes
sense. Yeah, so start small and get bigger. Oh, so, okay. So, yeah, so truck to ship refueling has been happening for many years. And so the innovation of your kit is that it's a standalone pumping product.
Correct, yes. I mean, I think what's interesting about the truck-to-ship fueling arrangements, and certainly, you know, the LNG industry has also evolved from the initial concepts of the truck-to-ship concepts. You basically take a road tanker there, you connect a hose to the ship, you start fueling, disconnect the hose, and that's it. And I think that's quite interesting to see how the LNG industry started to evolve on that concept, where they were then starting to bring LNG road tankers next to the ship. They would connect a hose across and they would do the bunkering, which worked perfectly okay in the early days with these pilot projects. But when you then think about it, actually, natural gas has very different properties to your traditional oil-based bunker fuels. And in that respect, there are additional safety features that needs to be considered around these kind of things. You know, natural gas is obviously a lot more volatile and more flammable in many ways than your traditional type of bunker fuels. And I'm speaking here from the experience also as somebody who sits on the British Standards Institute and looking after European and international standards and regulations around not just natural gas fueling technologies, but also hydrogen ones as well. And quite often in these standards, usually they will dictate that there is a safety distance that needs to be observed when decide to have, say, a storage tank full of flammable product that you were going to then discharge into another storage tank. So the idea of actually driving LNG road right next to ships is something that I feel that will certainly be brought into question when it comes to looking at the health and safety aspects of it, especially when you're then starting to kind of roll this out in a much, much bigger way. The risks become a lot greater because there are more of these kind of activities going on. Therefore, it's more likely that an incident is likely to happen. And even more so for hydrogen, which has an extremely large, wide flammability range as well, very volatile gas again. So the idea that we might think that we would want to try to do truck-to-ship arrangements in a very similar way to traditional bunker fuels without the consideration for safety is something that I think definitely needs to be considered a lot more deeply. And anybody that does try to do that should maybe think again about doing it.
Okay. All right. Thanks for that. So you put your bet on hydrogen as the fuel for smaller vessels, at least. How about for, you know, the large ocean going vessels?
Yeah, I mean, definitely, I think that's one of the reasons why we've looked at liquid hydrogen as a fuel. I mean, certainly we recognize there's an issue with energy density from a volumetric point of view. People say that you need larger tanks for LNG, you know, compared with traditional bunker fuels, and even more so for the hydrogen-based fuels, especially of compressed hydrogen. And therefore, it seems logical to think that compressed hydrogen would make sense for the smaller vessels, and that maybe something like liquid hydrogen is able to serve slightly larger vessels. And you know, we're talking about maybe vessels that have, let's say, 200 cubic meters worth of storage, maybe larger than that, all the way to, you know, thousands or the low thousands of cubic meters. And one of the kind of evidences for this kind of thing is actually looking at what are the largest LNG powered vessels that we're seeing on the oceans today. And certainly we've seen LNG powered vessels like of the likes of the Carnival cruise ships. You know, I believe the Idanova, for example, has enormous LNG fuel tanks on board to enable them to propel these massive heavy cruise ships. And whilst I can't speak of that company and their position on whether they think liquid hydrogen makes sense for them as a business case, what I can say is that that is a very good base on which to observe how maybe the future of technology may look. Now, I'm not saying that liquid hydrogen is the future fuel. I'm just saying that this is one of the very promising pathways. And certainly, you know, some of the other potential fuels that we are also actively looking at are fuels like ammonia. And we're also looking at things like liquid organic hydrogen carriers as well. And I know people talk also of methanol. And then if you want to dig even deeper into the hydrogen space, then you've got solid hydrogen in the form of sodium borohydride. So there are some very interesting innovations going on. And we'd be foolish, I think, to put all our eggs in the one basket and say that liquid hydrogen is the way to go. I think that the future holds for many different options. I mean, we've not even spoken also of electrification as well. And certainly for the smaller vessels, that seems to be an obvious way to go. But, you know, we feel that we need to back the most promising ones and the ones that we feel are closest to being commercial. And I speak also, again, from the experience of standards and regulation, because these are the things that are going to underpin whether companies are able to deliver these things and to say that we've built these units, but we've done them in accordance with international standards and regulations. Because the first thing that anything is going to happen when you're going to try to deploy these out and you, let's say, go to a port side and then suddenly the health and safety is involved in terms of the planning permissions and the consents and things like that. And they can say, well, you know, by which standards have you actually built your facility? Now, if those standards and regulations don't exist, let's say for ammonia bunkering, for example, and you say, well, there are no standards at the moment, then I think the planning authorities are then seeing these projects in a slightly different way. I think they would then consider these more as pilot projects. And in terms of the planning application, things like that, that would actually move a lot, lot more slowly than something where if we were to say, by the way, we've got a liquid hydrogen bunkering facility. It's meeting these standards. Here's the codes of practice, well documented. There you go. And then the planning authorities say, okay, you know, we're happy with this. If an international community has looked at that, then we're happy to go with it. So that's the way that we see things. I mean, that's at least one of the justifications why we're going down the liquid hydrogen side. I mean, I have another one.
As an investor in low carbon and zero carbon fuels, do you think it's, speaking more widely, do you think it's practical for us to anticipate or expect that zero carbon fuels can make up the percentage of marine fuels that will be required to meet the IMO's 2030 and 2050 decarbonisation plans? I think it's, was it the IPCC said we need 27% of marine fuels to be zero carbon by 2030? Do you think that's possible, given that we're just going from a standing start?
Yeah, I think these questions are always very interesting. You know, I mean, we've been watching very closely in terms of, you know, what the IMO is saying, what their targets are, what their ambitions are, what their assumptions are. The fact that, for example, according to the IMO, you know, their target is only 50% greenhouse gas emissions by 2050, which is completely at odds to, you know, the Paris Agreement, that ultimately we want to be net zero emissions by 2050. And what I would say to that is, you know, why does the shipping industry think that it's anything different than some of these other industries like aviation or road transport or heating, or, you know, that all are trying to do their own part in trying to get to zero emissions, net zero emissions by 2050. So I don't think we could necessarily expect that there's going to be some sort of special provision somehow for the maritime sector to kind of get away with it. I think that's just my personal feeling. And so we have to kind of observe and work on the assumption that we want to try to get to net zero emissions in the shipping industry by 2050 at least. And so if we start with that as a premise, then of course, then we have to work backwards. And then we have to say, well, do we actually really, you know, where do we have to be by 2030 in terms of getting all of these zero emission vessels out into the ocean in order to be able to get to our targets? And that means that we then have to look at what are the things that we have to do in a radical way to be able to enable that to happen. I certainly think that technologically it's very, very possible to be able to do that. And the idea that we want to launch this world-first liquid hydrogen bunkering facility in this year, right now, 2021, is a testament to the fact that we want to be building this infrastructure out over the next, say, 10 years or so. So that by 2030, we have a very wide network of perhaps liquid hydrogen bunkering facilities, maybe some other fuels into the mix as well, like your ammonias and things like that. That by that time, you know, I'd like to say maybe by 2035 or so, the zero emission fueling infrastructure network had been fully built out. And then that gives enough time for those ship owners and operators to make those decisions, to switch to those zero emission vessels. And it's probably no different to the way that we're looking at the phase out of diesel cars right now. You know, diesel cars are being banned by 2030, and suddenly in the next 20 years or so, we're going to see no more of them. So there's no reason why shipping can't also take this pathway.
But it would be your contention then that the infrastructure spend needn't be as large as some of the numbers that we're seeing, you know, in the trillions of dollars.
Well, I think so. I think there could well be an over-exaggeration of the amount of money. Look, I'm not saying that these things are necessarily cheap, but I think sometimes we have to also get away from the thinking of what the price of infrastructure is going to be based on today's costs. What we should be doing is looking at what is going to be the cost of the infrastructure based on costs in 10 years' time or 15 years' time. Because naturally, technology is going to improve. As hydrogen starts to become more prevalent and more players start entering into the market, then we'd like to think these costs are going to fall. And so, you know, the idea that we're going to be basing our assumptions of what the maritime sector's price of infrastructure is going to be like in 2030 or 35, for example, on the basis of infrastructure prices in 2021 is probably not the best way of looking at it. And certainly it's one of the things that we're seriously investigating, that if, for example, you know, we wanted to scale these facilities out in a far, far greater way than anybody's ever done it, how would that impact the economics of what we're doing today? Let me give you one really interesting case. We've had many inquiries already about prospective liquid hydrogen vessels, specifically ferries, actually, taking an interest in what we're doing. And they're saying, hey, we're building these ships and they're going to be ready in 2 years' time or so. Mm-hmm. And when we look at the amounts of liquid hydrogen that they're requiring, they're somewhere in the region of, I think, something like 16 tons of liquid hydrogen every day. This is quite a significant amount. And this is probably, as far as I understand it, almost something like 75% of what Europe is able to produce even today. Mm-hmm. And so to expect that, you know, one ship would take almost the whole supply of, or almost the whole of Europe's supply of liquid hydrogen just for the single vessel alone, is an interesting one. Because if suddenly they turned around and said, by the way, we now want 10 of these, then we're suddenly starting to look at a requirement of some 160 tons of liquid hydrogen every day. Right? And yep. If we look at liquefaction plants today, these are something in the order of maybe 15 tons per day, 30 tons per day. Mm-hmm. And, you know, nothing of that kind of scale that would be able to meet the needs of shipping as that demand is coming into my inbox. So something fundamentally may have to change in order for that to happen. And if we start to look at things that way, maybe we can start to see a different picture about how the economics of the reality of 2030, 35 may look.
Yes, because at the moment, if we want the hydrogen to be green hydrogen, then it's got to be produced by renewables, because there's nothing like enough scale in the alternative production methods like hydrogen fracking or plasma production of hydrogen. So and the other efforts at chemistry, so it's got to be renewables, and there isn't enough renewables capacity available to sequester from power generation to create all that hydrogen. So yeah, we're a long way from all of that, aren't we?
Yes, I mean, you know, let's not beat around the bush. It will be a challenge to scale up the green hydrogen production. You know, there are many companies now that are working on trying to build even bigger plants. And so, you know, we have to kind of take that in our stride. I mean, if we were to say, well, this is never going to happen, then nobody would do anything. There's no point in even trying. So the whole idea is that there is an ecosystem that's working together. And as we manage to bring some of those skeptics on board on our side, and to actually try to collaborate and build these projects up, and to actually spend more effort and investment and time and energy in building up renewables and things like that, then we would be working towards trying to get to our destination a lot quicker. You know, we'd like to think that, to say, you know, the more traction that we can build, that we can actually reduce these costs in an exponential fashion. So that's the way we see it. The other thing I think as well that maybe some people are not quite looking at is also the impact of China. I mean, if we think about where solar panels were, let's say, you know, 15 years ago, some people would have said solar power makes absolutely no sense at all. But we've seen that as China ramped up its production of solar panels, they became incredibly cheap and now forms probably one of the cheapest ways of producing electricity ever. So I think that hydrogen will take a leaf out of that book. And there are many, many things that are actually going on in China right this minute that perhaps the Western world is not really aware of what's going on. And they're maybe only making analysis based on the Western view of things. You know, I remember actually attending a conference and there was a presentation about what would be the cost of blue hydrogen versus green hydrogen. And I know that there's all this analysis saying that, you know, blue hydrogen and green hydrogen will be at parity by 2030. And there have been assumptions in that. And I think a lot of the assumptions were on the basis also of electrolyzer technologies coming from the Western world, like Europe and things like that. And even when it was presented by an organization from China, who provided, funnily enough, European prices, when it was put to them to say, by the way, what's the basis of these prices? Are they European or are they Western prices? The Chinese organization kind of became a little shy and kind of said, yes, this is kind of based on the European prices. In China, it's already a fifth of the price. What is fascinating is that the trajectory of how we see things from Europe, let's say from 2020 to 2030, and the price that we want to get to by 2030 is actually probably the price that China is already today. So could you imagine where the price could be between 2020 and 2030 from a Chinese perspective?
Yeah. I think the model of cost reduction as scale grows for new technologies is established, and we're all hoping that hydrogen and hydrogen carrier costs follow that same curve. So solar and wind have fallen 80% in the last 15, 20 years, certainly since the turn of the century, and they're now cheaper than coal. So that's all, you know, crossed fingers and hope that we can achieve the same results for hydrogen and maybe ammonia if we go down the ammonia route. But yes, it's a long way to go. But anyway, delighted to know that Unitrove is contributing, and I wish you the very best of luck with your trip to Glasgow with your liquefied hydrogen bunkering facility there, and wish you the very best of luck with Unitrove. I'm afraid we're running out of time for our recording, but very pleased to have had you on. Thank you very much, Stephen, for joining us and for speaking so eloquently in the cause of hydrogen.
Thank you very much, Mark.
Cheers. Thanks for coming on. And thank you to all of you out there in listener land, and look forward to broadcasting another edition of the Ship Energy Podcast to you very soon.